It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, we're speaking today with members of the Communist Caucus, which is in the East Bay of Northern California. We're doing two interviews with two groups that are inside the DSA, or the Democratic Socialists of America. And we're talking to these groups because we find that we have things similar and we want to understand why they're in a group like DSA, what that's like, what they get out of it, their own politics, and kind of what they're striving for within the wider organization. So just to start off, this could be its own podcast in itself, but, you know, communist is in today's world is very loaded. Obviously, if you watch any sort of right wing media, communist could be used to describe anything and everything. And I'm just curious for you all, what exactly does it mean? Most people, when they think communist, they think either Marxist-Leninist or, you know, a Stalinist type regime. Or they think something like social democracy in Sweden or something like that. And I have a feeling that communism to you, when you're using it, is something completely different.
So I think what maybe sets us apart from a lot of other communist groups is that our whole sort of central thing is about practical organizing. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop the practical application of communist theory and politics. So we really care about developing and experimenting in new militant organizational forms, because we feel that on the one hand there's a lot of these other socialist groups and they tend to focus pretty heavily on sort of ideological development, and then that becomes divorced from that can become divorced, or the sort of practical organizing component can sort of lack. And then on the other hand, I mean, social democracy, well, our horizon, what we want is beyond that. We want a stateless, classless society. So we just right there, that's the fundamental difference.
Yeah, and I think for us, the objective here isn't to sort of promote a set of ideological beliefs. Oh, sorry, that's our dog. Isn't to promote a set of ideological beliefs, like how Trotskyist cadre groups or similar sorts of groups try to do. Basically, we want to promote people to act like communists, and we kind of care very little about how they describe themselves while they do that. And so for us, it's really about a certain perspective on organizing and a certain perspective on what it means to empower themselves as part of the class in the wider sort of fabric of society. And so, I don't know, it's a classic question, right? Because there's all these people that want to debate about if the Soviet Union was a defunct workers' state or yada yada. I don't know. For us, we come from more of the left communist tradition in general, and so those questions don't really they're not on our consciousness or not on our menu of discussion very often.
When we think of the word communism,
yeah,
we think stateless class society.
Right.
And the ultimate vision for society. I mean, also, just really quick, I just want to say as an aside, a lot of Communist Caucus members would not consider themselves communists, which might seem interesting to a lot of people.
Yeah,
that's interesting. We'll have to talk about that. It's interesting, too, because the word itself, communism, predates, Marxist-Leninism, Marxism, the birth of any sort of, you know, communist parties as we would understand them. And, you know, even like anarchists, when they use the term communism or anarchist communism, you know, predates, you know, Leninism and all that stuff. But you're mentioning, one of you was mentioning, you come from left communism, which is something that basically throws out the Marxist-Leninist idea that there needs to be a vanguard party of you know, specialists that are going to lead the rest of us that are too stupid to figure things out on our own and create a new workers' government.
Yeah, I mean, for us, the important part of politics and what makes a politic truly revolutionary is the potential and realization of self-activity of the working class, of which all of us are a part. And so, I don't know, that is a distinction, I think, with some more vanguardist elements in the socialist sort of camp who understand themselves as, the vanguard, or trying to develop some sort of vanguard that can sort of lead the masses, to use the classic turn of phrase.
Yeah, and just practically speaking, like, if, you know, the sort of, if we want a completely new society run by working class people, which is what communism is, in the here and now, we need to be actually teaching people immediately how to, you know, run their own lives and make decisions, and, you know, they need to be able to actually have power
and act together.
Yeah, sure.
In a collective manner.
Yeah, and act together in a collective manner. So if people are going to run society, we need to be building the embryo of that today. So that's why it's so important for us. Like, we're engaged in this tenant organizing project called Tank, and that's part of it, is that, you know, tenants are coming together and they're actually able to start making decisions themselves over their housing situation, you know, which is unheard of in the Bay Area. So we want to see projects like this being developed in DSA, sort of answering the question of there's a broader question that exists right now, that you know, the working class, it doesn't exist as a political force, and so how can we start building ways that that class can become a political force? How can we start organizing ourselves in ways that can become that? And so we think that, you know, there's a huge potential for that within DSA to start answering that question in a practical way through experimenting with organizing projects.
Yeah, the experimentation is a key part of it. None of us think that we have some kind of like specialized knowledge that we're going to pass on, or like a secret to the revolution or whatever. I think really what we want to do is give people a framework of organizing where they can develop their capacities to confront capital in their daily lives.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that introduction. I just think that's something that we want to make very clear, that, you know, when you're using the term communist, you don't mean Marxist-Leninism and all that stuff.
What's Are that? You? Can you teach us?
So I think the next question is why did you all decide to get involved in DSA? Was this something that you saw that just seemed exciting? Was this like an intervention? You know, what caused you to get involved in this group? Because, I mean, now it seems like every single day there's something on the news about DSA. It's at 46,000 members last time I checked. You know, the right is scared of it. The center doesn't know what to do. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on why you personally joined DSA and decided to set up this group with inside of it.
So I think one of our main ideas or guiding sort of theories, and I think this sort of has given us a little departure from our fellow left communists. For example, folks who we all respect in EndNotes and elsewhere. I think one of our guiding theories is that the sort of future of like hegemonic politics, or what we could also call counter-revolutionary politics, is actually social democracy, at least in the United States. And so to our minds, getting in on this DSA thing early was essential because we want to be able to provide a different alternative and to force social democrats to answer to that alternative on an ongoing basis. I think that, and I think a lot of us think that if we don't engage with the social democrats on some level and force them to elucidate their position, to expose their cowardly sort of reactionary positions on various items, for example, prison abolition, then, you know, they're going to claim the mantle of the left and insofar as they could do that, recuperate all the sort of energy that exists today that can be channeled towards revolutionary action. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, it's an interesting position to be in an organization that you disagree with so immensely with many of the people. But I think that's part of the strategic outlook. And it's given us a voice that we wouldn't otherwise have in a field that is still relatively open.
Yeah. And the truth is that DSA varies from chapter to chapter, too. So I think a lot of us saw some advantage in the like national network basically that could exist among all the different locals, like coordinating like shutdowns of infrastructure, for instance, or things like that, coordinating among other like locals who are not as bureaucratic as the East Bay, that we saw value in that organizing model as well. Yeah, that there is a possibility to coordinate among other like leftists and the rest of the, oh my gosh, the rest of the country and then hopefully beyond.
Yeah, I mean, that it's like a double-edged thing where we're having political disagreements and political debates with people that are trying to become the next DNC leadership while simultaneously trying to organize infrastructure through that very organization of which they're a part that can and probably will in the future, if we're successful, resist those very people who take the realms of society. And so that's a tall order, I guess, but it's kind of like where we're oriented.
Yeah.
Maybe another thing worth adding is that when we talk about like these folks in the DSA that we have such stark disagreements with, we're mostly talking about the leadership or like right. In our chapter and in other places across the country. But like the vast majority of our chapter membership, we don't think is like super ideologically rigid or like they don't have any preconceived ideas necessarily about this is what needs to be done. They're just like they're activated and mm-hmm. they want to get plugged into something mm-hmm. bigger and do something. And so I think that's one major reason why the Communist Caucus is part of DSA, not because like we want to like infiltrate DSA and like, I don't know, whatever, turn it into something.
Turn into the Workers' Party.
Yeah. But just because like there are all these people here and it would be interesting if like we provided these alternative projects that they could be doing and plug themselves into. And most people that we talk to just on a one-on-one basis are, mm-hmm. like what we're interested in doing is it really speaks to them.
I also think that we've definitely had some antagonisms with the leadership, but they've all been really like productive antagonisms. For instance, it's forced us to write things about electoralism, which we may never have done. Like it gives us something to, it kind of helps us clarify our positions because we have something to like engage with or argue with. So I think it's really been productive for us as a group in terms of our organizing project, which we don't think ever would have happened if it wasn't for engaging within the DSA and et cetera. So, yeah.
And I think we've probably belabored this point, but I think it's important also to recognize that like the forces that we're organizing against and engaging with are highly organized and highly funded. You know, these are people who write for Jacobin magazine. These are people who are union bureaucrats or have positions in nonprofits. And these are people who have been part of sort of the reformist left for some time. And so they have a sort of foothold in a certain sense. And so inserting a revolutionary perspective in the midst of that is obviously an uphill battle. They've been around for a while, and they have real connections with people, unfortunately. So
I can tell that you're critical of East Bay DSA. I'm curious if you can kind of get into that and explain this kind of uphill battle. And I think it's really interesting. Somebody was bringing up just like union bureaucrats or people with Jacobin, basically left Democrats, and just kind of slugging it out and trying to articulate, a relevant proletarian position. I think that's really important, because I'm sure that those people within DSA that have social capital leadership are definitely looking at all these young people that are activated as, the troops that are going to go out and carry out their agenda, which most people, may or may not know exactly what they want to do. Although I feel like most people are more excited about organizing and running their own lives and struggles than they are getting somebody elected.
Yeah, well, it's a really complicated terrain to go over, and I think all of us would probably loathe to really get into all the details, but I think the most succinct way of putting it is that there is this activization among people who imagine themselves to be the next cohort of leadership within the Democratic Party and maybe outside of the Democratic Party in some capacity. And they've been really activated by Bernie Sanders and motivated, I should say, by Bernie Sanders and the sort of surge that came from anti-Hillary Clintonism and really what has been a wholesale collapse of centrism throughout the entire Western world. And so they smell blood. I think that they imagine there's an opening, and actually there is an opening. It's true. But it's a question of what the objective is. And it's also a question of how you get to the objective. So it's complicated because some people who have, so social democratic proclivities will maintain that they are socialists, even though by any measure they're an FDR Democrat. And so you're doing this sort of dance between what they do and what they say, which is kind of an interesting problem that I think a lot of us have never had to deal with before. Mm. And then there are sort of people who are honest about their social democratic reformist politics. And they sort of double down on this FDR vision of society and how we're going to ameliorate inequality through progressive taxation and how the electoral system is actually democratic. And insofar as it's democratic, we can use it to institute real social change because democracy actually exists in America. And so there's this narrative, that both of them engage with. And it's really seductive for people that are not activated, as we mentioned before, in an ideological sense, because we're sort of taught from a very young age that, how you get things done and how you change society is through this democratic process that already exists. And you just have to, it's a matter of engaging in it, you got to rock the vote and all this sort of thing.
Yeah. And so long story short too, I think a really important thing about DSA is because there's all these folks that are coming in that are not ideological and they're looking for something to do. The thing to do that's the most mapped out is the electoral strategy. And so it's really important to present. I think it's very important to present to people that are genuinely, I think, looking for something different and something powerful and meaningful, to present something that can actually meet those expectations. And so that's why we're trying to, offer what we'd like to do is sort of offer a methodology for developing class organizing within DSA. I know that I just pretty much just said something super abstract, and I don't know if everybody knows what the hell I'm talking about. But yeah, I mean, like, we need to present another option because what's going to happen is that, like, this whole group of people can just so easily get captured within that. And I just don't see that as a form of in my experience, that form of politics is just not very threatening or very very consequential. We're way more threatening if we're actually, organized as working people to be able to, shut down parts of society and actually have power in that way.
when you started, you were talking about just how difficult it was to basically exist in the space of East Bay DSA. And I'm curious, for those people that are listening to that, you know, exactly what that means. Like, why is it difficult? What are the political hurdles? You know, are people trying to silence your ideas because they're too revolutionary? Or, you know, what exactly are you kind of getting at?
It's really and it's kind of sticky, to be honest.
Sure.
Yeah.
But
for instance, they've really one of the more frustrating things about East Bay DSA is their tendency to block any organizing project that's not Medicare for All canvassing and canvassing for Jovanka Beckles, or doing things like canvassing for like a campaign or an electoral reform. They just added the Costa Hawkins canvas. So they have these canvasses around either candidates or electoral campaigns. And they've pretty much done a really good job at blocking other organizing projects. There was some people, I believe mostly from LSC,
Libertarian Socialist Caucus,
that were, I don't know if they were all LSC members, but they were part of this Breaklight mutual aid program. Mm-hmm. And then there was also like our tenant organizing project that we started as Communist Caucus and then transformed into Tank. That was like blocked and a few times when we tried to get signatures, or they were just kind of like hostile in general to the idea.
One of the people who is sort of in there, when I say there, I'm referring to the leadership of East Bay DSA. Yeah. One person was maybe it's not worth getting into, but
let me just go back to the last person's point. So, I mean, because I think this is key, because a lot of people would say like, well, I want to be part of a broader organization so I can have access to resources. So, like, you know, we could have money to make flyers to go out and do XYZ organizing
this
campaigns.
This is what we thought it would be like.
Okay.
We said, DSA, they have money, they have people, we have resources, this is perfect.
Yeah. And you know, some chapters are like that.
Yeah.
Almost every other chapter is like that.
But ours is highly bureaucratic with a steering committee that runs and makes decisions.
And our general meetings are very infrequent. It's only once every...
It was
months.
Like 4 months or something, but right now they just voted. People just voted to have monthly meetings, like just now. We haven't even had monthly meetings, and decisions were made in steering committee meetings of leadership. So the leadership weren't just political leaders; they were also like bureaucratic leaders, and it led to, in my vision, a very bureaucratic sort of top down, unhealthy chapter life.
Basically. Yeah, you're looking.
I was just going to say, there's obviously nothing wrong within the current political terrain of like people having free healthcare. Of course, you know, under the current conditions, we all would like that. I mean, I would love that myself. But I mean, if your entire organization is just basically, you know, canvassing to get something on the ballot, and then also just electing like the latest progressive there's already a lot of that in the Bay Area, then how is that different than any other nonprofit?
Right, they're exactly. Trailing nonprofits on the progressive wing of the Democrat. They're one step behind and trailing their positions, their campaigns, et cetera, instead of creating something complete, like another socialist option for how to like change the world. Yeah. So that's our biggest critique of them.
I mean, one way to put it, which I should credit to someone else here, this is their idea restated, but I think the real kernel of the like problem is that they accept popular opinion as it stands, and so they look out in the world and they see, oh, interesting, Bernie Sanders is popular and Medicare for All is popular. Okay,
socialism is ascendant.
Yeah, well, let's do that. But the problem with that is that, you know, you accept the world as it is, as opposed to agitating from the left for something that could be perhaps more interesting or more viable, even, you know. And when they do that, they sort of like fall into this trap of reformism, where you're advocating for something and you think that, you know, you draw a map from the thing in history, like, okay, we want Medicare for All. Okay, how do we get it? And you make a map going backwards to where you're at today, and then you follow that map. But the unfortunate detail they're missing in that whole like exercise is that reforms aren't sort of won in this like hyper, I don't know, this hyper rational manner. Reforms are concessions.
Right, and of course, yeah.
And so how do you get a concession? You don't get it by asking for it. You know, it's a concession. Right. And so
you have to put a gun at someone's head. Right.
Right, exactly.
And so there's a
miss. Not literally, of course, but
no, we didn't
through riots and strikes and occupations.
Hey, I'm talking to the lamp right now. We didn't say that. We didn't say that. It wasn't us.
Okay. So and something else we were thinking about also is like there's all kinds of ways to organize around health and healthcare. For instance, we live in Oakland where we're organizing in Oakland primarily where there's lead in buildings and water in Fruitvale. There's like health crises that exist for people on an everyday level, and that talking about free healthcare for people and in that sense is like, you know, people are also like trying to integrate like things like nutrition, hunger, things like that into more holistic idea of what health is and what a movement around healthcare looks like.
Yeah.
That's more dynamic and would be more, have a stronger ability to build a strong movement where people are organizing around the issues of their everyday lives instead of just for an abstract bill that gets killed by some Democrat over and over and over again. We're getting into our electoral question, but building that power to create a movement around healthcare that can actually exert our will instead of, you know, begging the state managers to let us have, you know, some free healthcare or something.
And I mean, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but I mean, you know, the American system takes literally trillions of dollars from working class people and uses it towards state programs. It just happens to be largely the military and the Pentagon and, you know, police and all that stuff. So, I mean, it's not like socialism is somehow like some foreign idea to the state. And like, if you look at like everything that a lot of tech capitalists are saying, like stuff like universal basic income, which I'm sure like in 10 years will probably be, you know, if not implemented, like something that a large section of the elites will be like pushing for, like as automation continues to be more of a thing. And, you know, they look at the fact that, you know, this world is in the middle of a collapse, and then unless they, you know, basically give us certain things, there's going to be large scale revolt.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, there's no other way to contain the contradictions that are inherent within the system. So, I mean, socialism itself, I mean, I would argue is not even necessarily a revolutionary idea. You know, you can have capitalism and socialism. I mean, like Bernie Sanders would argue, like his whole thing is, you know, basically capitalist societies that have, you know, healthcare and, you know, basic welfare programs, which again is not necessarily bad from the standpoint of those of us that don't have access to those things, but it's not, you know, a society that's the, you know, what we're actually after.
Yeah.
I mean, this just reminds me of like the relationship to between us and DSA. I mean, you have this situation where all these people want healthcare. They do want these programs, particularly people that are joining DSA. And so we're able to have a conversation with people and say, look, you know, how do you get that? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's this one method where you canvass for a candidate who says they want to institute it through legal means. And then there's a whole another perspective, I should mention, based off of a historical based off of history that demonstrates that it's a change of where the center lies, you know, so to speak, depends on how strong or weak the working class is in any particular moment. And so even if that's what you're aiming for, if that's what you're gunning for, well, you need to be 10 times more scary than the canvasser who's asking for a meager single payer system in the state of California.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's continue forward and let's really get into the heart of this talk around electoralism. And I mean, as you see it, because you're inside the organization, I'm sure you're on, you know, loops and emails and all that stuff. I mean, is there a tension within DSA around electoralism versus direct action? Because there seems to be kind of both camps. You know, there was I think a lot of people were really excited when they saw everybody going out and doing like the, and I know you all were involved in this, but like the brake light thing, sort of like mutual aid, dual power projects, you know, and also just, you know, DSA mobilizing to go out to, you know, all the big stuff that's been going on from, you know, Resist and Unite the Right to, you know, police killing people and all that stuff. So I'm just curious, like, as you see it, how does that look inside the organization? Or is that tension even there? And also, like, for those of you that are trying to, like, you know, basically pick a position and push that way, what does it look like to push back against, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party and just electoralism in general?
I think he heard DSA and then he turned off. Yeah, there is a tension.
Here, wait, you can just start and then I'll do the rest.
There is a tension in the DSA on this question, but you know, we're an agitational minority politic in the organization, but that's okay. Like, you know, that's part of the sort of like calculation that we've made and that we continue to make, because our real objective is to try to reach an audience that is politically motivated, and DSA provides that for us. And so there is a tension between us, between some other caucuses, for example, Refoundation Caucus, which I would call more of a traditional Marxist-Leninist, maybe with Maoist characteristics.
I don't know.
No?
It's all different.
Well, it's totally different, but they're definitely a little more like orthodox Marxist, maybe in some respects. I think we all like them just fine, by the way, but they are critical of, the Democratic, especially on the Democratic Party question, it seems. There's the Libertarian Social Caucus. They're obviously critical of electoralism. And there is like, so there seems to be quite a few people, probably thousands of people who are critical on this question. And then, you know, against a few thousand more people that are very convinced that electoralism is the way forward. But the real thing is that most people in DSA are pretty ambivalent on the question, and I'd say open-minded with some prejudice towards electoralism just because of the state of hegemonic politics in the U.S., but who are nevertheless open-minded and not ideologically bound to it. So it's an interesting terrain, and it's an ongoing question that we have. Yeah, and we did write something about electoralism. There was a debate about endorsing candidates here that can be read on our Medium page. If anyone's so inclined, but yeah, I don't know. Our plan is to try to continue expanding, you know, a criticism on electoralism, but the best way to do that, I think all of us agree, is by putting forward, real actionable alternatives. So part of the problem with a lot of the other caucuses, and I do really appreciate them, and I love them dearly. Respect for my caucuses.
Our learned colleagues.
You just got to smash, huh?
Well, there isn't much of a practice happening on a caucus level, but I'm sure a lot of people are doing stuff as individuals or maybe in smaller groups. And so what we're trying to do is really put together a perspective on what it means to organize in a communist manner. What does it mean to build working class power? Or to put it really succinctly, what does it mean to build power as opposed to access power? You know, that's really, I think, the question of the day for people in DSA in general. And so we plan to hopefully soon expand Communist Caucus into a more national caucus with a national presence. But we've been cautious on that matter because we don't want to be a sort of like a discourse-only group. We want to have real actionable things to present. We want to have real actionable things to coordinate, shutting down infrastructure, blocking the flow of capital in different places at the same time. You know, we want to be able to actually have a footprint in the real world as opposed to exist
just owning people on Twitter.
Yeah. Hot takes.
Yeah.
But we're good at that too.
I've been fighting
for the respect I deserve. Repping A and B, especially when they hated my words. Treating me differently, dissing me, giving me shit, it was killing me. Found the ability to never let the bullshit hurt my spirit. Telling myself to put it all in my lyrics. Anytime I'm shining, the devil wanna make an appearance to cause an appearance. Talking shit about us, I hear it, but never doubt it. I'm fearless, and I be counting and clearing them numbers. How come don't nobody want us? When I was coming up, it ain't nobody really love me, I'll be honest. When I'm feeling nervous in my stomach, roll up marijuana. When the devil is upon us, I'ma kill him, that's a promise. Promise. Waking up every day and I'm on it. Proving I made is wrong and murdering every opponent. All the grinding every night to finally get to this moment. To spit it and own it. You're never gonna get rid of a soldier, but I ain't never let somebody try to tell me that I'm less than. Never trust somebody with a bunch of fucking yes men. Never will I let up with the freshness. If you're coming at me, I'm responding with aggression. Yeah. I was born to be the man I am, and I will never give a damn about another hater of his life. Let him see it when you look at me on everything you took from me. You'll never kill the fire in my eyes. Still I rise. When you falling off, they ain't there to help you out when you need them. Waving a flag for you, reckon that they a homie. But only when you was popping, you at bottom. Watch your followers leaving. Thinking and I don't see them scheming, homie. I done had experience spotting fake friends, plotting with their co-conspirators. Backstabbing dates back to the beginning of mankind. Drawings on the walls up in Egyptian pyramids. But I won't let them get me. Little Brutus did a Julius. I'm losing friends that hang around me. Do it cause it's lucrative. As soon as it don't benefit them, put they through the coop again. I seen the way this movie in before, and it behooves me when they said it with the movement. But they soon abandon shit. But when they say outlandish shit, trying to assassinate your character. Swear that they was there when you started. Say you changed since the fame. They the one been acting strange. Homie, with the Lord for me to get to where I'm at, I'm in a cakewalk. I believe in God, I'm grateful that he blessed me. So much pressure, it gets hard for me to stay calm. I wonder if it's just a way for him to test me and see if I'ma let it put me in the graveyard, or am I tough enough to suck it up in next seat. There ain't a day go by that I ain't getting hate from people that ain't never met me, but still I ride.
So no room for opinions of Johnny Fairplay. Punch a rip in the face with the mauve color comments. I gotta come in, I'm second guessing my own day and what I might say. So many butt hurt, but what's worse, ain't enough ass band-aids to make work. Shit's deep, real wolves can't be concerned with the comments of the opinionated sheep. So I block them all away, wanna throw shade while I'm handing out umbrellas and an ain't no sign of rain. I'ma rise through the pain like I'm made another cane. And I've been a living legend since the very first day. I'm a battered and abusing my contaminated brain, and I'm here to terminate the competition in the game. New day, fuck you in the trumpet. Cut Othello's hand off and fed it to the puppets. Fuck you in the heart cause it's deeper than the ducats. Watch it crucified by the public. Tell me do you love it? All the things you covet, die. The moment that you made me pick sides. I am not the ordinary sheep, I aspire to be the shepherd. And you can follow me when I fucking rise.
What I would like to see developed, and keep your eyes out, but is we're going to be sort of developing proposals for a methodology for how people can sort of organize wherever they are. Like how can you start thinking about doing that? You know, because there's not, you know, while we don't think we have the answers, there's a certain logic that you can go about of how can you sort of analyze where you are and start thinking. And start, analyzing where you are, and start thinking about, you know, how can you take that and then take the forces that exist there and organize them, you know. So, for example, here, you know, we have the Port of Oakland or whatever, maybe wherever the listeners to this call live, you know, they live somewhere else. There's different forces. There's different things to organize. So we want to sort of develop a way for people to think through developing organizing campaigns. And we have some ideas, and we also have some ideas to propose for DSA of specific campaigns that we think are sort of applicable in many places across the United States. So we're going to be writing something specifically about like public housing, because that's something that is that exists in many places across. Yeah, right. So And furthermore, like, this isn't something that we've, like, officially decided, but, you know, what I would like Communist Caucus to become, as if it becomes a national, body, is sort of a conversation between different people who are putting communist politics into practice. So in other words, each group, each sort of local. Oh, hello, sir. Each ma'am. Local, excuse me, ma'am. Each local communist caucus is engaged in some sort of form of organizing that's trying to answer the question that we talked about before of, like, how can we start, you know, what are effective ways that we can organize working class people today? They're trying to answer, you know, each group is trying to answer that question, and we can come together. You know, there can be a national network of people who are trying to answer this question. We come together and we discuss it, you know, monthly on a call. Like, we can update each other on what projects we're doing and how they're going and, like, shit like this. Like, it'd be tight as fuck. And we can learn from each other too, you know, because you can learn a certain amount, you know, just from the process of organizing. But imagine if you were linked up with, like, 10 other groups that were all doing that and were doing different things. Like, you could be answering all sorts of questions, you know. The capacity there is just so much more expanded. So there's all sorts of things that, you know, that we could be trying out, learning, and just developing a new form of communist organizing.
Experimental communism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're going to be talking about Tank later, and I'm really excited to hit on that, especially as, like, rent strikes and, you know, more autonomous organizing is happening in housing struggles across the U.S. and Canada and beyond. But, you know, just as one aside, since you're on the program, I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts, you know, surveying the national situation in the U.S. I mean, with Trump, there's just all this crazy crap going on right now with, you know, Russia, and everything seems to be up in the air. There seems to be kind of a new push, perhaps, from some of the elites that, you know, Trump will be gone in some way. And then, you know, there's also, you know, everything else that's going on in the country. I mean, I don't need to spell it out for you, but I'm just curious, you know, your all thoughts about, you know, the national situation and kind of, like, what that necessitates for resistance.
I think, to keep this brief, because I think people have heard too much about Russia, and and it seems like, you know, maybe we need to be prepared for some strange thing that will happen around this Russia thing, but it's hard to predict. But I think the thing that all of us recognize is that the Trump moment is really hard for people, for revolutionaries who are organizing in places that are liberal strongholds, like the Bay Area, like the coast, basically, and all of that sort of thing, because there's this sort of, like, mentality or idea that there is this resistance that exists and this sort of unity that must form to oppose this trash president that we have and the nightmare. But the problem is that the real break for revolutionary politics and revolutionary power is liberals in our circumstance. That isn't true for everyone, but here in the Bay Area, 100% true. And so the question is, how do we both produce a politic that acknowledges and is able to try to resist this sort of, like, rightward turn nationally, while also maintaining an antagonistic and properly critical relationship to the sort of liberal institutions that exist, okay, and sort of recuperate revolutionary energies on an everyday level here and now in the Bay Area? I don't think we have the answer to that question, but that is really the, if we're going to look at it nationally, that's the strategic question that has to be answered.
Yeah. And you brought up recuperation. I'm just curious, can you all talk about, you know, more and more, it's people are reading about DNC, Democratic candidates, you know, basically lobbying for support of the DSA, and, you know, the DSA, you know, deciding what candidates it wants. I'm just curious, can you spell out more, you know, about the relationship between the Democratic Party and the DSA?
I mean, the truth of the matter is that it's highly contingent on like where you're looking at and which DSA you're at. There are some locals that are more
Boston Reef Foundation or something just made just one, right? Because Boston just decided not to endorse any candidates.
That's tight.
Yeah. Whereas like New York, they're like endorsing Nixon and
exactly.
It really varies.
Yeah.
You have to remember that the structure of DSA is decentralized. It's more of like a federation of locals. And so that's what makes it a great place for revolutionaries to organize in, because it has no central command mechanism to discipline its membership.
And not really. I mean, nothing. We had one member suspended.
That was a local command.
Oh, they have a lot of power locally. Nationally, they don't have a lot of power. Like, in terms of, like, political lines and things like that, they don't have a lot of, power in that sense.
Yeah. So depending on where you are, it can be relatively easy to sort of, like, steer your local DSA in a more left or revolutionary direction. So it just really depends.
Yeah.
Is the end goal of the Communist Caucus to make the DSA a totally different group, or is it simply to pull people into it from the larger organization?
Pull people into it from
Up until now, we've sort of had a really interesting inside-outside sort of strategy, at least. Mm-hmm. I don't know, this doesn't really answer the question to what we're trying to do with the DSA nationally. Like, are we trying to change everything? Maybe this person over here has an answer for that. But up until now, we sort of had this inside-outside strategy where I would say about half of our members joined DSA just to be in the Communist Caucus, or join DSA reluctantly right around the time when there was something that they needed to be a member for. So actually a lot of people that we have in our, in the caucus have come from the broader left in the East Bay and have like been interested in what Communist Caucus does. So then they join DSA or just come to Communist Caucus meetings, sometimes without even being DSA members or knowing anything about the DSA. So, and then we also have drawn some, also people from the DSA who've joined Communist Caucus. So it's been this kind of interesting inside outside, at least in terms of the people that we've joined.
Yeah. It might be disappointing and boring, but I don't think we really have a grand vision for like taking over the DSA necessarily. We just want to be active members in our chapter and like propose projects that people can get involved in and provide like we were saying earlier, frameworks that people around the country can take up and we can link up with them. But
awesome.
Yeah.
And just as a last little note, I mean, I think our view of DSA is just really agnostic. We're
pragmatic.
We're not like all in it. We're not hating it. We're not loving it. You know, we're really flexible. And so our relationship to DSA as we've continued to grow has been totally dependent on what's happening, what is advantageous, what makes sense. It's a really strategic question, and so it's hard to give a straightforward answer because who knows what's going to happen tomorrow or in 2020 or beyond that. You know, we need to be prepared for all options. Yeah. And so that's the reality of the situation.
And it's a big public thing that is out there and people know about it and they can attach themselves to it. Like I wouldn't have been interested in joining the DSA personally, but I saw the Communist Caucus statement when it formed, and that was my way in. And I probably wouldn't have seen that if it wasn't like part of the DSA. It wouldn't have been quite as widely broadcast.
Right. And we're going to talk in a second about the really interesting stuff is the housing organizing you're doing. But real briefly, do you foresee a split within the DSA like around 2020? Like, I don't know if this is the magic question, but I mean, like, will there be, some people that are just like, oh, this isn't what I signed up for. You know, I don't want to elect, you know, the next generation of shitty Democrats. Or, you know, which, you know, might be good because then some people could actually go into a different direction. I'm just curious your thoughts.
I think as a caucus, we don't have a position on this, but I think that we all agree that a split, a productive split or a non-productive split could happen. And it's on the table. It's always going to be on the table. It's the nature of the left. And but to the extent at which a truly productive split happens depends on people organizing within the DSA and people who are prepared to make that to actualize that if need be. And so it's really dependent on what happens and what happens in 2020 with the election and, you know, what happens with Trump. I don't know. There's a lot of like variables, so it's hard to tell.
Right. Yeah, nobody knows.
Well, let's talk about Tank. What are you all doing with this project? You're in the Bay Area, which is just this epicenter of gentrification, tech capital, displacement. Hit hard by the foreclosure crisis. A lot of homes were bought up by different companies. Rent is continuing to grow, to skyrocket. So what are you all doing in this context?
I just want to say one thing and then I'll let someone else speak, just because we haven't mentioned this yet. TANK, it's a great acronym, but we haven't spelled it out yet. It's Tenants and Neighborhood Councils.
Oh, yeah.
That's what TANK means, FYI. Okay.
So what's TANK? So we sort of touched on this a little bit before, but our idea is, you know, working class self activity. So what we're trying to do here is it's a okay. I was just getting a funny face. So what we're trying to do here is working class self activity. So our idea with TANK is that
how it manifests is that it's basically a federation of tenant unions that are structured around individual landlords.
Yeah.
So we have public meetings once a month that anybody can come to.
They're called assemblies.
And so this is the model, basically. Anybody can show up to this assembly. They give us the their landlord information, basically, or like just their address, and we do research on their landlord, and then we help them do outreach to link up with the other tenants, however many there are, that rent from the same landlord, and then they get together and talk about what their issues are, and magically they all realize that they all have the same issues because they all rent from the same person. And then they can use their power as tenants. They use their economic power to withhold rent or whatever, to make demands on their landlords, which are the manifestations of capital in their daily lives.
Yeah.
So it's basically the model for TANK.
And so this sort of differs from other forms of tenant or organization that sort of, you know, there's other tenant groups that sort of, are based on a service model. They provide services to tenants. Like for example, you know, they might provide some like legal research, or they might, they might provide advice to tenants or this sort of a thing. And that's valuable, but we differ from that model in that, we're not just trying to provide services to tenants, but we're trying to actually develop a weapon for them to use against their antagonist, you know, the landlord. So that's what the council is supposed to be. It's supposed to be an institution that is run by tenants, and where tenants make decisions about, you know, what they're pissed off about in their housing situation, what they would like to change, and to practically collectively organize against those situations.
It also differs from another sort of nonprofit model, which we can call the activist model, which sort of like aggregates tenants in this sort of random fashion by knocking on doors, usually with paid canvassers to accumulate either members, which fund the organization, or people to sign petitions. For example, the Costa-Hawkins repeal. There are quite a few organizations that are sort of like activated acting as activists around that issue. And so it's totally different from that model. as well, which is another nonprofit sort of thing we see here in the Bay.
So, for instance, how we see it is the activist model takes random tenants, which is like, you're a tenant, and takes them to Sacramento to advocate or to like lobby or do a quote, even sometimes a direct action, like I'll go to the state capitol and advocate on behalf of some like bill or piece of legislation or something. But what that does to, in our minds, is take people out of the area or the place where they actually, or the point where they have actual power and their relationship with their landlord. So it takes them out of that relationship, out of the place where they actually have power to withhold rent, to organize collectively, et cetera, into this other sphere to organize with random tenants from, you know, anywhere else to advocate and try to like appeal to the state. So we see this as a model of like putting power back, or putting organizing and putting power back into the tenants' hands where they actually have it in their ability to, you know, withhold rent, et cetera. Yeah.
Just as all workers derive their power from being able to withhold labor, we as renters get our power from being able to withhold our rent. That doesn't mean that every council is like going to go on rent strike or whatever, but they're organized. and they could totally do that, mm-hmm. because they're organized and they're together.
Yeah, and it's
certainly. You don't want to remove people from that position that they actually have power in, and take them out of that arena into a more advocacy sort of model, or more, in our mind, activist model.
And there's like all this talk about rent control and this Costa Hawkins campaign that has come up a few times. Like that's a California law that places limits on like the kind of rent control measures that cities can institute. But like, we see real rent control as coming from this kind of tenant power that we're hoping to help develop.
Something we talk about is developing the tenant power in order to make the demand of rent reductions across the board.
Yeah, because our rent's already too freaking high.
Yeah, we want rent reduction across the board.
Yeah.
These are kind of the kinds of things we want to be able to demand and have the power to demand.
And again, we don't want to ask for reforms. Right. We get them as concessions.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is, as well, like at this point in here in Oakland, San Francisco especially, but just the Bay in general, as you probably know and many listeners know, rent control expansion at this point is totally inadequate. People are paying 50-60% of their income to rent. And so what really needs to happen outside of the total abolishment of every landlord that exists is like straight up rent reductions. And like, you know, we're not going to get that by means of legislation. We're going to get that through people exerting their power, through being a true threat. Yeah.
You could, as a council, possibly reduce your rents around just your landlord, you know, making these.
If you push hard.
Yeah. You could be saying, fix our gates that don't work, our doorbells, or you could say reduce our rent by $300.
Yeah. Right. We see a lot of possibilities with this model, right?
Yeah. And, you know, throughout this conversation, we've been talking about, groups coming together and also kind of coming to the realization that DSA is not providing resources for different organizing projects. What do you think the possibilities are if you look at groups like Autonomous Tenants Union in Chicago? I mean, there's just so many different tenants organizations that exist now, or there's like Parkdale Organized, which is like a self-organized tenant association.
Yeah, Lila.
In Canada, that's, you know, organizing different rent strikes. What do you see the possibilities of all those different kind of formations, you know, potentially working together? How could a movement, radical, self-organized, autonomous, anti-capitalist housing movement grow in today's world?
Yeah, that's a really.
We had a call with Autonomous Tenants Union.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Those fools came to our meeting, the Autonomous Tenants Union.
They're not fools. We like them.
I mean that in an affectionate way. Agnostic.
But yeah, I mean, there's huge potential. I mean, capital is moving back into urban centers, and we have all these tech jobs. Amazon in Seattle, we have Uber, we have, you know, all of these like fancy groups, corporations really are sort of moving back to the sort of centers of urban centers. And so as a result, there's this like wave of displacement and wave of gentrification that's occurring. And so there's huge potential to organize around that specific contradiction. How to do it in a way that isn't merely about rhetoric or the moral concern for one another is an interesting question. Like how to coordinate, for example, rent strikes between cities is an interesting question. An even more interesting question would be how to coordinate rent strikes against the landlord who owns properties in multiple cities, which is becoming more and more the norm.
Yeah, and many of them are backed by venture capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, I mean, it's an interesting question that will only... The answer to that question is only going to happen through struggle. You know, we can speculate on it, but we really need to engage with one another seriously and try to like put forward a strategy, a shared strategy.
Yeah, and so and just sort of a proof of concept. The effectiveness of this strategy. You know, we locally, you know, the first landlord that we organized against, you know, we did. Okay, here's another buzzword: workers inquiry. You guys can look that up. So we use the sort of inquiry model. We sort of petitioned. The renters of this landlord named Linda, what is it that they're really upset about? And the biggest thing that they were upset about is that the most common and biggest thing that they were upset about was that Linda was not allowing them to choose subtenants. So in other words, what that means is like, you know, if you live in a house with like five people, as like many people do in the Bay Area, you know, two, three, four, five people, if one person moves out, she had this really strict process for who you can replace that person.
Strict and inconsistent.
Yeah,
strict
and if this yeah. building that they were living in is rent controlled, then whoever that moves in basically yeah. has to be able to pay market rate, which is sometimes over $1,000 for a room, yeah. even if the room itself is only $400 or $500 under rent control.
Yeah, so it was really disruptive to people because if you're of the sort of income of or sort of like class position of people that are paying $500 rent, you know, you don't know a lot of people that can afford market rate, you know, so it's very disruptive.
So the fact of the matter is that this practice was driving displacement.
Yeah, yeah it was driving
because displacement. If she can force people out, then. There's a new lease and there's no rent control and it can be raised.
In fact, with many of the tenants of this particular landlord, there were quite a few who for quite a few months had been just paying an extra room's rent.
Yeah.
And thereby doubling their rent, the rent that they paid her just to cover it, to maintain their rent control because if they left, maybe it'd be a couple hundred dollars more at a new place. And so it was a strategy that she employed to like basically try to get people who have rent control protections out of their properties. And so we started organizing the tenants. And once we got them together to chat about it and did inquiries, figure out what people are concerned about, what they're dealing with, that was like a major issue.
Wrote a letter.
And so, yeah, we basically... worked with tenants, organized them for quite some time. Tenants wrote a letter, and the letter basically asked the landlord to clarify her position or her policy on these subtenants. This is all really boring details, but
she just totally caved. Like we won that demand, and it was the biggest demand.
Yeah, she and now basically she gives a recommendation. And so she says, oh, if I were you, I wouldn't have that person, but it's up to you. And she also sent a letter to every single person that was a tenant of hers saying, please don't organize.
Yeah. and she sent them gift cards to seize candy. Yeah, she did.
And so that's been a big success. People are really enthusiastic in that tenant council at this point, and they're still
organizing. So it seems like a small thing, but it like Galvanized. Didn't come from – a whole lot of effort, really.
Right. Well, that, I mean, that totally illustrates your point about concessions and, you know, where does actually power come from? Does it come from some, you know, supposed democratic process where different classes of people that have completely different, forces behind them sit down and have a nice conversation? Or does it come from, you know, a class doing battle with another class? Exactly. And, people basically saying, like, this is what we can do to you if you don't do what we want. And we all know what this system does to people every single day. And it's very rare that our power comes out.
Yeah. And to be honest, from our perspective, the point really isn't about producing gains for people or enriching their lives, although that's a great side effect. The real thing we're trying to get at is to empower people to take matters in their own hands, into their own collective hands, mm-hmm. and to feel empowered in that particular way, so that when they face issues in the future, they know, well, look, if we get together, we can take care of this. You know, it's an agitational practice. And so how this little win is, and in a lot of ways, it's not small because it really impacts people's ability to stay in their apartments. It's like really about like radicalization and agitation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? So when we were talking in very abstract terms earlier about communism and communist practice, this is what we said.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Now, nope.
Yeah, and imagine what the United States would look like if 46,000 members of the DSA were all doing the same thing, and instead of just sitting around waiting for the next Bernie Sanders to come and, you know, sweep away the badness.
Well, also the idea is also sometimes different things. Like, for instance, we were in contact with a group called Southern Communists, and they were talking to us for a while, and we kind of told them about our ideas about like taking stock of your situation, your area, what are the important points of infrastructure or things like that. Mm-hmm. And also like doing like an inquiry of people around you, like what are the most important, like maybe right here in the Bay Area, we have this like housing crisis. And then we said, well, what would it be there? For instance, we were just kind of talking through things and they just immediately were like retail workers. That's the thing to do mm-hmm. here. So there are a lot of ways that maybe this exact same thing, you know, with housing doesn't work every place, but there's like a methodology behind it of like mm-hmm. collective struggle and collective class struggle that can be. Mm-hmm. That can be inspire all kinds of different models kind of like this. You could have like a retail workers, you know, assembly or, you know, you could have a lot of different things, but a lot of it has to do with taking stock of your area. And for instance, like the canvassing model that is developed in Philadelphia and East Bay may not work in the South, which is what they were saying, which is what they're frustrated by. Mm, it may not work everywhere. So it's all about taking stock of where you're at and how to organize most effectively with, you know, what you have, et cetera.
Yeah, I think the last little detail about this that should be mentioned is that like the end goal is to build working class power. I mean, the end goal is to produce collectivities that wield real power. And so if we can organize even 30% of the tenants in the East Bay, which would be a huge feat, obviously, but not even a majority, just 30%. If there was a social movement, a murder by the police, a war, or something that has to be resisted, people can be activated in a way that could actually cause an effect in the greater economy, you know, and that is the really important thing to signal here, that there's a bigger question of revolution and of stopping society and blocking the flow of capital. That's like a central question with this organizing.
Yeah, we also really want to create something more dynamic and something more than just these tenant councils. That's why it's called tenant and neighborhood councils. So there's a lot of different components to Tank besides just tenant councils. Like for instance, I'll list some things off, and I know someone else will probably want to talk more in depth about some of it. But for instance, we're talking about maybe a push to, or we'd really like our next project to be a push to organize around public housing. HUD and Ben Carson's proposing huge austerity measures and cuts to public housing coming up. We also have a propaganda wing where we make the different posters that say like take the city from May 68 posters, and then crush landlords instead of capital and say take the city with the fists and stuff. We also create different kinds of posters, pamphlets, et cetera. And we want to have like street teams that do like wheat pasting and putting posters up and having, you know, events where people can get literature and materials, et cetera. We also have a component that is going to start doing like educational events, lectures, have different people speak on the housing crisis, or, you know, all different kinds of educational things. We just got a bunch of copies of the Housing Monster,
which is a really fabulous kind of critique of everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Pearl.info.
Yeah. Everyone should read that.
So, you know, we wanted people, like, you know, beyond just fighting for your tenant, you know, also creating, you know, political education and things like that. Also, like, we would love to show, like, the Parkland film. We were really inspired by Parkland in Toronto. Mm-hmm. We'd love to show that film for people. And then we also have all of us believe that no movement is complete without like street demos. We need to have demonstrations in the streets about the housing crisis, about, you know, homeless encampment evictions, et cetera. We need to be like have a presence in the streets, which is something we'd like to build our capacity for. Two more things I'll just say really quickly: homeless defense. Also, what can organizing a neighborhood look like? It can look like anti-ICE defense. It can look like anti-police organizing, et cetera. Kind of thinking through those things. And the last one we were thinking of is creating cross-class solidarity. So maybe having community picket lines or working with the public union workers who clean up all of the homeless encampments, who do all of the sweeps. So there's a more dynamic vision of Tank besides just the tenant council model. I don't know if you want to talk about the public housing. But.
Yeah, I mean, I think for anyone who's really interested and who's made it this far into the podcast, the thing to look out for is we're going to really focus on a big push for public housing. In our estimation, there could be a lot of potential for organizing in public housing, given the austerity measures that Ben Carson and the Trump administration want to push forward. And something that we haven't really talked about so far, but something we all believe is like, we're not really for unity of the left, but we're for unity of the class. And so it's really important to get people who are renters.
Can we just stop? Because I feel like that's a point that we've been trying to make for a long time. And I mean, we had a conversation with some people in Philadelphia, and we kind of made this point. And you know, everybody wants to run around and unite like all these different little socialist and communist and anarchist groups. And so. But there's millions of people around you that are literally going through hell. And people don't want to go outside and knock on their neighbor's door and do some real shit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
that was an intervention that we've been trying to make with DSA is to say, like, look, DSA represents a very particular segment of the working class. Mm-hmm. It's like the sort of part of the working class that has become increasingly proletarianized post-crisis. And it's people who have experienced intergenerational losses, or majority white, who are typically white collar workers, et cetera, right? And so DSA appeals to a very like small component of the class. And insofar as that segment is isolated from other parts, it's never going to be effective in any real way. And so what we need is unity within the class. And the question is, okay, how do we get that? Well, that's a hard fucking question. But one small step towards that, we think, is organizing public housing, helping people get organized in public housing, kicking off public housing assemblies, having demonstrations for both, you know, anti-gentrification alongside public housing. It's the same question, you know? And so that's going to be our big project, I think. And we're hoping to push that on a regional and if we are lucky, national basis, because you know, it's a great opportunity to organize, and it's something that has to be resisted. I mean, it's ridiculous to burden people who are in public housing with higher rents. I mean, it's just going to exacerbate.
It goes even higher after that.
Yeah, it only gets worse. And so I don't know. There's a lot of things to say about it, but you know, that's kind of the long and short of it.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you all coming on the podcast. I think it's great to have these conversations. Anything else you want to talk about? Anything else you want to mention that we haven't hit on?
we love It's Going Down.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are great.
Thank you. We would encourage people to follow Tank, especially on Twitter. It's at TANC Bay. And it's just, I mean, I think all the housing stuff going on is fantastic. And I think the way that you all are talking strategically about looking at the major contradictions and where people should organize and all that stuff is smart. And that's what people should be doing. And thanks for talking with
Can
us.
Can we just do a few more plugs?
Sure.
So our Tank Twitter, I feel, is lacking. It's a little – the Communist Caucus Twitter is pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah, it's good.
DSA Communist Caucus. And then also we – our website is just baytank, baytanc.com. So we have a website, both our Twitters, Facebook, and then Medium you can find by DSA Communist Caucus to read our original statement and our position on electoralism.
Yeah.
Slide into our DMs. DMs are open.
DMs are open, fam.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.